Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Sleep schedules always are a problem when it's time for children to return to the classroom. But now there's the COVID-19 spin. While some are sleeping better at night, others have struggled with disrupted routines, later bedtimes, and more screen time. Perry Class writes the weekly column, The Checkup, about children's issues in the New York Times. Her forthcoming book is titled A Good Time to Be Born, How Science and Public Health Gave Children a Future. Welcome back, Perry.
Thank you.
So some kids are sleeping better, some are worse. Who's what? I mean, who's sleeping better? Let's start with the good news.
Well, one of the things that I was interested to see, there's been a study of 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, and 6-year-olds in China that suggested that in these circumstances, in the lockdown, at home with their parents, they were going to sleep later, not a big surprise. They were sleeping later in the morning, not a big surprise. That they were actually sleeping about the same amount in a 24-hour period compared with kids who had been surveyed in earlier times. But parents were reporting fewer sleep problems, less trouble putting them to bed, less night waking. So that was kind of good news, that is to say, or at least worth thinking about for these younger children, the possibility that this schedule had actually solved or been less likely to produce some of the sleep disorders that you see in younger children.
Like a schedule or the lack thereof a schedule.
Well, so one possibility that the researchers speculated was that maybe for children that age, being around their parents more in one way or another, having sort of more meals together, more family time, was actually contributing, that what we were sort of seeing maybe with this fewer sleep problems actually reflected something larger and nicer in the family dynamic, which might be a nice thing for stressed out parents to contemplate, that you know, that time that you're giving to your children and spending with your children is actually helping them, even if you can't always exactly identify how. So those are sort of the children at one age of one end of the range of school age for kids who are home. And then the other group who, and this is, I'm hearing from a lot of colleagues, for some adolescents, this has been helpful for the ones who really suffered with getting up very early for early school start times, who could never, and we know that some of this is hormonal, biological with teenagers, that clock reset that keeps you up late at night. And so for the kids who were really struggling with that, some of them have liked this schedule better, but that doesn't mean that with school starting up, whether it's real or whether it's virtual, they are not going to need to rethink it.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Perry Class, a pediatrician and professor of journalism and pediatrics at NYU. She also writes a weekly column, The Checkup, about children's issues in the New York Times. And we're talking about sleep patterns in the age of COVID-19. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about screen time? Not only are they more have more leisure time during this period, stay home time, but they're also now going to be learning remotely in many places.
Absolutely. And I think that even though we know that in many families, for many different reasons, all the rules around screen time have had to change. Parents are working on screens. Everyone is communicating with family and loved one on screens. All of that's absolutely true and valid and not something that you want parents beating themselves up about. But for the sake of sleep, there are a couple of things you want to hold on to. It's true for little kids. It's true for big kids. And honestly, it's true for us as well as adults. You need that hour at bedtime without a screen. Your brain needs to calm down and relax. So you need to find something else to do for at least the hour before bedtime makes sense. And you need to get those devices out of the bedroom. And even in the case of phones, we know out of the bed. And I honestly, I'm telling you something that I and my colleagues, adult colleagues, people with medical degrees, something we all struggle with ourselves during these times in various different ways. This is not an easy instruction to give necessarily, but it's something important. You need to negotiate it with little kids. You need to negotiate it with adolescents. You need to be able to put the screen down, turn the screen off, put the phone down, even now when that screen is how you're learning and how you're communicating. Your brain needs to calm down and you need to sleep sort of separately.
You know, getting back to the issue of adolescents and their trouble getting up in the morning, we've had, I can't remember if you've been on the program to talk about this or not, but it's certainly been talked about for years now, the problem, the disconnect between the typical adolescent sleeping pattern and this kind of very regimented factory-like schedule of schooling. And I'm wondering if there's an opportunity here to study that, to address that. Maybe don't start classes at 7:45 in the morning when they're remote. Start them later. Does it make a difference? Do you see some opportunities?
I think you're speaking for every adolescent sleep specialist I know.
Okay.
That here, you know, here in a setting in which for a lot of kids, they're not going to be all of those extracurriculars. You're not going to be worrying about sort of some of the scheduling and even overscheduling that adolescents are subject to, that maybe this is a chance that we could reset things a little and see how the kids do and look to see whether there's evidence going forward. And we know there already is a fair amount of evidence. We know that waking teenagers up early in the morning for many of them, it makes everything problematic from their sort of their driving, if they're driving to school, to their studying and their memory. So yeah, I think people are seeing this as a little more of an opportunity, as a possible opportunity, if the schools are willing to do it, to let the teenagers be a little more in sync with their circadian rhythms.
You reminded me of an episode, or like the beginning of an episode of, I think it's called The Middle, this sitcom, and she's trying to wake her son up in the morning, and she starts out with, it's time to get up, and then by the end of the scene, she's flipping the mattress over and knocking him on the floor, and he's like, ah, Mom, and it makes me wonder about the stress of, the arguments that start in the morning and that kind of a thing, and if you could just get rid of that stress in the morning, that's got to be a mess for some families.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think, the flip side of that for many families that the sleep experts talk about is for many younger children, their clocks are set differently. So you've got a young child who's maybe hopping out of bed before the parents want to get up, full of energy and ready to learn. And then you've got the adolescent who's got the class starting at 7:45 and is supposed to do some kind of athletics before that, who doesn't easily fall asleep until, much later at night. So, yeah, absolutely. I think we all know parents are facing and have faced and have been heroic about facing a whole set of challenges in juggling schedules, but it probably makes sense to think about any ways that we can reduce the stress on families and the stress on scheduling going into this very complicated, very problematic fall. A little less stress would be a gift.
So how important is sleep to health in children? Is it different for them than it is for adults?
Well, I mean, the sleep specialists would tell you it's very important to all of us. But some of the ways that we see it show up specifically in children are children who are sleep deprived, it can look like they can't pay attention. It can look like they can't concentrate. It can look like they can't settle down. It can look like they're irritable. I mean, anyone who's got a child, a small child, it goes a little with the personality, but it's not that you necessarily see sleep deprivation in children as a child who's yawning all the time, although you can see that, or as a child who's falling asleep in school, although you can see that, but you might be seeing a child who's irritable, or a child who's having trouble paying attention, or a child who can't sit still. And as we know, those are tremendous issues for the other kids in the class and for the teacher. They're tremendous issues if we're asking kids to learn remotely in terms of their being able to concentrate. And they also can sometimes shape the perception of how that child thinks and how that child acts and how that child learns. In other words, I think we see a lot of behavioral issues in children who are sleep deprived.
And then there's another issue in the morning, and that's breakfast. If they're not getting up at a, you know, and how that relates to oversleeping, the stress in the morning, that kind of a thing. What do you think about that? I mean, I grew up in the instant breakfast generation. Then there were the Pop-Tarts, and now I don't know what they're eating.
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence that we want children to get a reasonable, healthy breakfast in the morning. We want them to get some protein. We want them to get some complex carbohydrates. We also, I think, and we're all very aware of us, especially those of us who had school children of our own, we don't want to give parents an impossible challenge to meet. We don't want them to feel guilty if sometimes the breakfast when you are going out to school is kind of getting grabbed on the way and eaten, as long as it's a reasonable, nutritious breakfast. Kids do better with breakfast. I think one of the issues that has come up when we think about kids going back to school or not going back to school is the question of whether some children were getting those breakfasts in the school and whether their nutritional needs are actually going to be met if they're going to school remotely or going to school remotely some of the time. And it's one of the lessons that's come up again and again in this in our discussion about schools is that for so many kids, school supplies so many of their wants and needs or is a way to help families in so many different ways. So breakfast is really important for kids. And I think it's something that many families creatively over time figure out what works for them, what works for their kids, what works for their schedules.
How for the strict bedtime that was abandoned during the spring and summer, how do you recommend or how do the specialists recommend that children get back on schedule, a sleep schedule for school? Any ideas?
So 2 points, or maybe three. One is start now. Don't leave it. If you've still got a week, if you've still got 2 weeks, even if you've still got 3 weeks, you wanna try not to do this all in one leap, which might leave a child during that complicated first week not feeling completely awake. What you need to do is you need to start waking up a little earlier in increments, right? You need to wake up a little earlier tomorrow and a little earlier the morning after that and a little earlier the morning after that, because the child's not going to go to sleep earlier until the child is tired. And the other part of that, and I know parents are doing all they can, but you have to then not nap during the day, not let the child spend the whole day kind of sleepy and staring into space and drowsing. You have to try to keep active during the day, wake up a little earlier, and then try the earlier bedtime when the child's a little tireder. And you can calculate now, any family can, the difference between where the bedtime is now and where the bedtime needs to be. The other two things that sleep experts would say about this is once you've got it reset, try to keep it steady on weekends, especially with younger children where you have some control. If you can try to keep it pretty constant, that helps. And finally, the other thing that one of the sleep experts whom I talked to said to me that really struck me is it's not just bedtime routines, which help your body clock, your circadian rhythm stay steady. It's also eating at the same time. It's exercising. You know, it doesn't have to be rigid, but a little bit of the scheduling, it's getting some natural light first thing when you wake up so your body registers it's daytime. It's that hour at least of screen-free time in the evening. It's kind of getting your body in tune with what you're asking this child, what you're asking yourself or what you're asking your child to do. So we shouldn't just think of it as bedtime routines. We should think about it in a larger way as how the day goes and how our bodies respond.
Perry Klass, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, happy to be here.
Perry Klass is a professor of journalism and pediatrics at NYU. She also writes the weekly column, The Checkup, about children's issues in the New York Times. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. As many as 5 in 10 patients with severe cases of the disease caused by the novel coronavirus enter hospital intensive care units with kidney injury or failure. That's according to a recent report from the American Society of Nephrology COVID-19 response team. That level of injury and failure to the kidney calls for some form of dialysis, and that's expensive. Medicare costs topped $84 billion per year before the pandemic to treat chronic kidney disease. We're talking about the relationship between kidney disease and the coronavirus, as well as kidney disease in general. It's the 9th leading cause of death in the U.S., according to the CDC. Dr. Uday Nori is a transplant nephrologist at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Transplant Center and an associate professor of medicine. He also directs OSU's Nephrology Fellowship. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me back again.
What do we mean by acute kidney injury?
So there is an important distinction between the chronic kidney disease that you mentioned and the acute kidney injury. The acute kidney injury is typically seen in a hospital setting, typically in the context of severe acute illnesses or even postoperatively. If patients underwent some complicated surgeries, that would be one of the complications as well. So compared to the chronic kidney disease, acute kidney injury progresses pretty rapidly in days instead of weeks or months and requires quite a bit of a multidisciplinary type of approach in their treatments.
When it comes to kidney injury or kidney disease, is it ever reversible?
So the chronic kidney disease is typically not considered reversible because it's a slow process. The healthy kidney cells are replaced by what we consider scar tissue. So the filtering mechanisms get damaged in most instances permanently. As opposed to that, acute kidney injury is somewhat reversible in many instances, although many studies have shown that patients who had suffered acute kidney injury have a higher risk of chronic kidney disease in the long term.
And what is known about why acute kidney injury is showing up in patients with severe COVID-19?
So it's important to understand that acute kidney injury has always been our Achilles heel in critically ill hospitalized patients. But what made COVID-19 disease a lot more important in terms of AKI or acute kidney injury is that because of the inflammatory substances that circulate in these patients, which is now very well known, that caused a lot of organ damage in those patients, has affected kidneys disproportionately. And we are still trying to understand all the reasons why kidneys are at the front and center of the internal organ damage. So one thing is worth bearing in mind. Even though kidneys weigh maybe around 1% of a person's body weight, they filter about 20% of all the blood circulating in the body every minute. So they're very dependent organs requiring high maintenance. So you can imagine critical illness can cause a lot of circulatory disturbances, with organ, the perfusion of blood flow and so on and so forth. So it's not really that hard to understand why kidneys become a target so early on. But COVID-19 is especially harsh on kidney function.
When you refer to, we're talking about chronic kidney disease a few minutes ago, you talked about the scarring of the lining of the kidney and that kind of a thing. When there's acute kidney injury, what's going wrong there?
That's a good question. So most people do understand kidney as composed of filtering units where the blood is being filtered and urine is coming out.
Mm-hmm.
But before that fluid gets out as what we know as urine, all the fluid passes through a very long convoluted tubes. We call them tubules. And during that passage, the kidney decides what to retain, what the body needs, and what to eliminate. including water, including a lot of toxic waste materials, including some of the medications that people might be taking. If the lining of these tubules that are so sensitive and so important in the filtration process get damaged, which is what happens in the acute kidney injury, the function stops pretty rapidly, actually. But okay. Kidneys are pretty resilient. Given enough time, given good health restored in the body, these tubules are very good at repairing themselves, but they do need that underlying cause to go away so that there is a fighting chance for them to recover.
And then in the meanwhile, that's when dialysis comes in.
Absolutely. Dialysis is it's not going to change how the kidneys recover, but at least in the meantime, they are keeping the blood chemistry and the fluid balance as accurate as possible.
And dialysis, that replaces the tubules?
Well, we call dialysis artificial kidney.
Yeah.
The membrane is a very low sophistication. All it does is allow the blood to mix with a special fluid that we pass through the dialysis membrane, and it allows the toxic materials to be exchanged from the blood into the specialized fluid. But kidneys do a lot more than just filtering the blood. They maintain your bone health. They control the blood pressure. They control how many hormones are being generated. It's a very important organ in actually making your bone marrow work to make your blood cells. So obviously, the machine doesn't replace all of the functions of the kidney. And besides, so another point I think is worth reminding your listeners is, no matter how much dialysis we provide on a daily basis, it still is only replacing about 10% of the native kidney function.
Okay. I was not aware of that. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the kidneys today and the relationship between kidney disease and the coronavirus and just kidneys disease in general. It's the ninth leading cause of death in the U.S., according to the CDC. Our guest is Dr. Uday Nouri. He's a transplant nephrologist at Ohio State. He also directs OSU's nephrology fellowship. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The American Society of Nephrology report gave a range of around 10 to 50% of patients with severe COVID also having kidney injury or failure requiring dialysis. That's a big range. Why the large range, and when do you think we might know more?
So that's important to understand, because when we look at scientific journals and publications coming through them, they're being reported by either individual medical centers or sometimes a large number of organizations within a geographic distribution. So because of the urgency of this pandemic, I think the medical community did not have the opportunity to be able to launch a well-designed, statistically sound study where they're able to acquire data in a very systematic way. So, but when you report data from individual centers that so much of variation between the type of people who are being taken care of, for instance, data from China may not be necessarily applicable to USA because of the type of people who live in these different areas. So the range is because every study observed their own local disease burden. So to be objective, I think in societies issue guidelines or information like that, they like to refer to what is actually being published. So with time, I hope more and more centers may choose to report to a registry or a database so that individual centers don't have to carry the burden of reporting these many, many, many smaller studies. Instead, a database or a registry would be able to collect all the data and make it look more robust. Now, when it will happen, how long it will take, it's a matter of speculation.
You know, talking about kidney disease as the ninth leading cause of death in the U.S., according to the CDC, what causes kidney disease? Is it something genetic? Is it lifestyle? What is it?
So the leading causes of kidney disease today across all the countries, not just the United States, are diabetes in about 50% of the cases and hypertension, high blood pressure, in about 30% cases. So it's mostly to do with lifestyle, you might say. There are many, many other conditions that can also cause kidney disease. Some of them are genetic, some of them are immune-mediated. those may not be necessarily something that patients can modify. So when we do have systemic diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure, like many other internal organs, kidneys are also in the line of fire. But kidneys are specifically, just to repeat what I said earlier, mm-hmm. they're especially vulnerable because they are filtering organs, so they are very sensitive to some of the systemic damage that occurs inside of the blood vessels that are trying to do the filtration inside of the kidneys. And because of their specialized nature, they tend to undergo damage much more readily than blood vessels in, for instance, the liver or some other part of the body.
Are kidneys easy to transplant? I mean, easy in a relative way, of course.
Well, we are discovering more and more about how to push the boundaries. You know, that's a whole topic by itself. But at Ohio State and elsewhere in the country, we practically doubled the number of transplants we are doing. Going from 180 transplants a year, we've now, as of this year, have about 340 kidney transplants we were able to accomplish. With of course, it's a multidisciplinary programmatic effort, not mm-hmm. any individual effort. It's not easy, as in, so the surgery itself is not that complicated and taking care of it, but it's the demand of organs.
Okay.
Not sufficient number of living donors step forward, and in the waiting list, the deceased donor transplant supply is very, compared to the number of people waiting, it's very small. So hypothetically, if there is an unlimited supply of organs, we would be transplanting, I don't know, 10 times, 15 times more than how we are able to do now.
What about donors? I mean, is there a danger? Is there a risk? I suppose there's always a risk when you're donating an organ, but what are the concerns?
So living kidney donation had been in practice since 1954,
okay,
which was when the first transplant had happened. And since then, more than 100,000 people had donated and successfully so. So because we are actually asking healthy human beings to donate an organ that they don't have to, there was intense scrutiny on both their outcomes, about how do we evaluate them, and who we allow to donate. So we have very long and very well-documented history of safety with living donations. So that's the reason why medical community strongly encourages people to come forward. And we don't allow them to donate unless, of course, they complete their evaluation and unless the transplant center is completely happy with how those donors look.
And, of course, I'm going to make a leap here and say you don't get paid to donate. That's very discouraged, isn't it?
Well, I think people worry about losing their living wages because a very large number of young people, they are hand-to-mouth. I mean, they don't have a salary as such. They don't have the luxury of taking 6 to 8 weeks off, which is how long it takes. So that's been the raging debate. Even okay. within the medical community, there is a big section that endorses using paid donors, but that's obviously not the practice right now. But it is definitely a discouragement, no question about that.
It creates ethical issues.
Correct, exactly. But there are bills in the Congress right now that are looking at protecting them, meaning protecting the living donors from future medical insurance, a lack of access to it,
mm-hmm.
Making sure that there is some form of, not reimbursement, but taking care of their transportation, taking care of their lodging, things of that nature. So there are some efforts to, even though we are not going to be able to pay, to not put them through hardship in other ways.
Right. There is expected to be a surge of cases of kidney disease, acute kidney injury because of COVID-19. What is your sense about the nation's preparedness for a surge of cases from the pandemic, I guess when it comes to kidney dialysis infrastructure?
To me, I think the messaging that's been out there for anybody who is at risk of COVID-19 applies perfectly to people who are suspected to have COVID-19, chronic kidney disease. But I think me and the people who are in our nephrology practice, the main concern had always been that there are a vast number of people walking around without realizing that they have chronic kidney disease. And they usually don't get symptoms unless they lost about 80 to 85% of their kidney function, and that's way too late
mm-hmm.
to pick them up and prevent that level of progression. And so getting tested, asking their doctors whether they have kidney disease because they have risk factors is a very, very important point.
How do you test for it?
Well, it's not easy in the sense there is no one single gold standard test, but it's a combination of checking the urine for microscopic amounts of protein, checking for blood in the urine, and there is a blood test called creatinine that is very cheap. It's pretty much done on a daily basis and patients who need it. Those are the ones that need to be done and interpreted. It's very important that interpretation goes into that and also eventually to be communicating that to the patients. A lot of people do get tested. Medical records show that they had chronic kidney disease, you know, pre-existing, but a large number of people don't even recognize that they had chronic kidney disease. So because they didn't have that information, many times when we see them in the hospital, they're shocked and surprised that they didn't know that even when they had it in the medical records, that they weren't made aware of it. So my message really is to not only get tested, but they need to have a clear understanding of what percentage kidney function they have left.
So a couple questions. Does insurance cover kidney testing or kidney disease testing? Okay.
Absolutely. Like any other diseases, kidney disease is covered automatically, but Medicare, CMS, cover kidney disease explicitly only when patients start dialysis or require a kidney transplantation. But until the point of reaching dialysis, unless patients are more than 65 years of age or if they're disabled for some other reason, CMS doesn't pick them up. So that's a little bit of a hardship. If they're uninsured, if they're unemployed, it's hard for them to go get tested.
All right. And then are there any symptoms of kidney disease? Or you mentioned earlier that by the time there are symptoms, it's too late.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Gotcha.
Unfortunately, so. So doing the testing is the only way. And I also volunteer at the National Kidney Foundation. I've been doing it for a large number of years. So we do screening clinics, especially in communities where kidney disease is rampant. Past 5 months, all our activities came to a standstill because we are not allowed to bring people in for any meetings or screening clinics and things like that. So my fear is that a large number of these communities that have high prevalence of chronic kidney disease are now even more disadvantaged because nonprofit organizations like us are not really, we don't have the opportunity to go out there and do the testing and screening.
Dr. Nouri, I have a call from Candida in Lakewood. You're on the air. Hi, Candida.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay, I like to ask the question. My brother was just rushed to Cleveland Clinic. He has diabetes and high blood pressure, and they're doing dialysis every other day. And I was wondering, is there any way that he can repair his kidney?
Well, I mean, I don't know if Dr. Nouri can comment on a specific case. Dr. Nouri?
Well, I think it depends upon how much of it is chronic and how much of it is acute, because people who have chronic kidney disease because of diabetes, they are at a higher risk of developing acute kidney injury. So, which is why I was commenting earlier that if I, as an individual, know that I have a stage 2 or a stage 3 chronic kidney disease, I'll be very careful about how I conduct my lifestyle. And if I think I'm at a risk of acute kidney injury, I would inform my doctors ahead of time that I do have chronic kidney disease. So in your brother's case, you know, it's hard to comment without knowing all the circumstances, but if there is an acute component, that hopefully can be reversed.
Okay, Candida, I hope that helped. Dr. Yude Nouri, thank you so much for your time again. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on the air.
You bet. Dr. Yude Nouri is a clinical associate professor of medicine and program director of the Nephrology Fellowship at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Feeling guilty when you're grieving isn't unusual, but COVID-19 has put a new spin on that, too. David Feldman is a counseling psychology professor and author. He is a frequent contributor to Psychology Today and hosts the Psychology in 10 Minutes podcast. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So how has the pandemic, I don't know if it disrupted or changed the grieving process in general?
Yeah, I mean, enormously. I think it's probably a massive understatement, right, to say that we as a country, we as a world are very much grieving. And I think that this has shifted a bit since the early days of the pandemic, right? I think in March, in April, we were all aware that COVID was a big problem. There was a lot of COVID anxiety going around. But most people, even though they were aware of the numbers, weren't personally affected by the coronavirus. And I think what's happening now, last time I checked, there were 175,000 deaths in the U.S. alone, and I think almost 800,000 globally. You know, 175,000, that's the size of a small to medium-sized city. So people are now being personally affected by COVID. Either they've had it, they know someone who's been very sickened by it, or they know someone who's died of it. I just think about myself. I've had two people. One person has actually died of COVID and was a friend of mine, and another person, very close friend of the family, is very sadly in the hospital right now on a ventilator, and you know, her family, excuse me, is starting to say that maybe she is going to pass away. And so I think this really brings grief home. And yet, our normal ways of grieving are really obstructed by the virus. So just as an example, think about the ability to be with the person you love while they're very sick, while they're in the hospital, while they're dying. This is an important way of grieving, frankly, even though it's before the loss. Mm-hmm. And we're not able to do that because of coronavirus restrictions. So I was just talking to a colleague a couple of weeks ago whose mom, a very elderly mom, got sick, not of COVID, mm-hmm. but very sick. She took her mom to the hospital, and the doctor said, okay, we're going to admit her to the hospital. You can go home now. And my colleague had never thought about it, but at that moment she realized because of coronavirus restrictions in most hospitals, she wasn't going to be able to be with her mom. And as she was driving away, she felt enormous guilt. She never said goodbye. She never hugged her mom or held her mom's hand. She never was able to say, I love you one last time. Now, this has a happy ending. Her mom survives and is discharged from the hospital. But for many people, they aren't so lucky. And this sets up a horrible set of circumstances leading to a lot of guilt. And that's why I wrote this article in Psychology Today, because I wanted to discuss that guilt openly and talk about how we can work on ourselves internally if and I dare say when we start to feel that kind of guilt.
Is it always easily identifiable? Can we always distinguish the guilt from the sadness?
I think that's a really, really good observation. No, I think that guilt is so interwoven with grief sometimes. You know, I worked in hospice and palliative care for many years as a psychologist. I've walked down this road with many wonderful caregivers, family members, sons, daughters, husbands, wives. And what I've noticed is very few of them get through the loss of a loved one without having some guilt. And so it's in there, in that sort of swirling tank of emotions that is grief. And yet I think often guilt really tortures us. And I think there are two kinds of guilt that I can address more if you want.
Yeah.
One of them is I didn't do enough. And the other one is I did the wrong thing. And I really wanted to address both of those because I think oftentimes we are way too hard on ourselves when we have guilt. So, you know, with the I didn't do enough, I think of one particular fellow. He was a middle-aged guy he was losing his very elderly father. And he lived out of state. And he flew home probably a dozen times in 6 months, just pre-COVID, to be with his father as his father got weaker. It must have cost him a fortune, took him away from his life. He was an amazing son. And then one day he received a call from the hospital saying, your father is imminently dying. And if you want to be with him, you've got to get home now. So he jumped on an airplane, and unfortunately, he didn't make it home in time. And he tortured himself. I mean, what a horrible situation. He tortured himself for not being there when his father took his last breath and felt enormously guilty and really flew into a deep depression. His mom pulled him aside and gave him really amazing counsel. And I think it's exactly what psychologists would say to him, which is, look, I can't necessarily stop you from beating yourself up about not being able to be with your father when your dad died. But if you're going to spend time beating yourself up for that, also make sure that you're acknowledging all of the amazing things you were able to do for your father, all the amazing ways you were able to be a wonderful son. As a psychologist, I have to say we're wired, and there's neuroscience research on this, we're wired to focus on the negative. It's what helped our ancestors to survive in deep evolutionary history. And so it's part of our genes, and this can really cause a lot of guilt in the aftermath of a loss. And so I think his mom's advice is exactly right, that maybe we can't will ourselves not to feel guilty, but what we can will ourselves to do is to make sure we're also really acknowledging the amazing things we were able to do. And then for the second case of I made the wrong decision, mm-hmm. I think the key there is to really look at what we knew at the time of the loss. So I had a friend who was caring for his elderly grandma, and his grandmother was sick but not dying. She was living at home, and her fondest wish was to die at home. And yet she fell and she broke her hip and was in a lot of pain and panicked. My friend called 911. They rushed her to the hospital, and she was in a lot of distress, and she ended up dying in the hospital. And he blamed himself, right? I did the wrong thing. I shouldn't have called 911. And yet I think what would be so important for him to reflect on, and what I tried to help him reflect on, was that he can really only be responsible for what he knew at the time. He had no way of knowing that she would die. And he can't be responsible for not having a crystal ball. He did what any reasonable person would try to do, which is to call 911. So I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind, that none of us do have crystal balls. And that can help sometimes with guilt as well.
This whole situation with isolation from the people we love the most when they get sick is so anathema. Now, it's like we've been trying to become more, you know, over the last couple decades, it feels like we're becoming more comfortable with death. We're trying to the passage and all that kind of stuff. And then we get thrown this whammy of COVID-19, which just is it's not just the hospital experience. We can't even have funerals now.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you think about, again, how we are wired as a species, because, you know, as a species, we've been around for hundreds of thousands of years, and we've been grieving for that entire time. And we are highly social, highly interpersonal, highly communal creatures as human beings. And if you think about all of our mourning rituals, all the ways that we grieve in community, right? We go and we visit the person, if we can, in the hospital with other family members. When the person passes away, we have funerals. We come together. I'm Jewish, and one of my favorite Jewish traditions is this thing called sitting Shiva, where in the 7 days after a loved one dies, the close family members literally just sit in the house, often around the dining room table, and friends and family come in and sit with them. And they talk about and reminisce about the person who has died. And also the community and the friends do all the housework and cooking to give the family a chance to grieve. And that's just really not possible. And you can right now, and you can say, well, we could do this via, you know, Zoom or whatever. And yeah, that gets part of the way there. But I think, you know, we all know with Zoom fatigue and all the things that we're experiencing now, that connecting with someone via a screen doesn't have the same emotional impact as being with someone in person. So yes, coronavirus is disrupting our ways of grieving, and there's no magical way around that. What it means is that we have to develop, new ways of grieving solo, you know, within ourselves. And again, that's why I've written so much on this recently, trying to give people tools for combating those things like intense guilt that can happen when you sit in a room by yourself, right, and reflect on what has happened. I don't know about you, but when I'm by myself and I'm experiencing negative emotions, I often go into sort of a self-attacking mode. Mm. And I think we need to be really careful about that when we're not able to be in community. We're not able to have loved ones to sort of snap us out of that.
Right. All right. So you've written about holding on to hope during this time. And yeah. There's a, I guess, a thin line between hope and delusion. So what's the strategy there, and how do you know when it's in itself become maybe not so healthy?
Yeah, I think grief and hope, right? These are the two things that are the two sides of this coin that we're experiencing as a nation and as a world. I've had a lot of people ask me recently, because as a professor, as a psychologist, I study hope, you know, have asked the question, can we still hope? And I think present in that question is the assumption that we can only have hope when things are going well. And actually, I totally disagree with that. I think that hope is at its most powerful when things are not going well. And there is obviously a lot of grief, a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, health suffering, financial suffering, interpersonal suffering out there right now, no question. And so I think there are a few things to keep in mind to buoy up our hope. One is that hope, we can definitely have hope even when things are bad. Hope is a perception, a belief that a better future is possible. And that's not dependent on how things are right now. Rebecca Solnit, the great essayist, once wrote, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher her words, but she said something like, you know, when the forces of bad are amassing against us, whatever that happens to be, the way that we can really let them win is by giving up our hope. Hmm. That as long as we maintain hope, really the forces of evil haven't won. And I think that's so important for us to keep in mind. The second thing is that hope creates reality. And I know that kind of sounds magical, but it's not. Hope is a perception of a better future. And having that perception in our hearts, in our minds, actually helps create reality. So I've done some research where we actually measure people's hope in goals in their lives. This was pre-COVID. And then we follow them for a matter of months. And what we find is those people who have more hope in particular outcomes, when you follow them months later, those outcomes are more likely to have actually happened. And this isn't magic. It happens because hope keeps our motivation alive. It keeps us in the game.
When you're talking about hope, are you talking about what the silver lining is? Okay, this happened, but then there's this.
Right.
It's
a good question. No, I'm not talking about saying there's something good about COVID. Absolutely not. There's nothing good about COVID. COVID is awful. What I'm talking about is holding on in our heart of hearts to the idea that we can get through this, that a better future does possibly exist. And let me say one thing that might help to clarify this. Hope is, and we have a good amount of research on the conditions under which hope can thrive in people's lives. And it turns out that hope is fueled by action, even small action. So I would encourage people to think, if they're feeling hopeless right now, if they're feeling depressed, to think about what is one thing that you can do, even a small thing, that might help to give you a little hope, that might help to move towards a future that you value, whatever that is. Hmm. So as an example, I was talking with a friend, I guess about a month and a half ago.
Mm-hmm. We're running out of time.
And she was feeling very hopeless. And I gave her the advice, do something. So she started making COVID masks. I mean, you could say this is such a small thing.
I think a lot of people have done that.
Small act fuels her hope.
David Feldman, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
David Feldman, author, speaker, professor of counseling psychology at Santa Clara University. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.